Revelation chapter 2, starting at verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last, who died and came to life. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and for 10 days you will have tribulation. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who conquers will not be hurt by the second death.
Sam, thanks for reading for us. Can I add my welcome and say how good it is to have you with us, especially if you're here at church for the very first time. We're so honoured that you've come and that you're thinking of joining our church family. This first picture is Rome, the world's first mega city, the place that ran the empire that ruled the world. And it's hard for us to get our heads round Rome's reach, but if you think about it, every aspect of the New Testament story from Jesus' birth onwards, remember Caesar Augustus with his census, all of it played out under the domineering influence of what they called the Eternal City. Domitian was probably the emperor at the time Revelation was written. He was from the family that built the Colosseum. And as Roman emperors go, he was definitely at the mad and tyrannical end of the spectrum. Liked people to call him my Lord and my God. If you wanted to grab people back then with a vision of something bigger than Rome, you'd be stretched to do it. But the story of Revelation so far is of a bigger vision, a bigger person, with eyes like fire, feet like bronze, and a voice like the roar of many waters. He calls himself the first and the last. He died and came to life, we just read. He truly owns titles like eternal and Lord and God. John has seen a vision of Jesus shining in glory, and there is no bigger vision. There is no greater voice to tune into. This is Jesus speaking to us here, personally, piercingly, pastorally. These letters are about specific first century churches, but by Jesus' Spirit, they are what he says, present tense, to his church as, plural, all of them. Hence, anyone who has an ear, listen up to the Lord of all. Verse 8, to the angel of the church in Smyrna write the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. Smyrna, claimed to be the birthplace of Homer, the Greek guy, not the Simpson. And Smyrna had captured a vision of just how much Rome could do for them. Smyrna was in competition with Ephesus, where we were last week, in competition for the title of Roman first city of the region. I guess Jesus has just ended that competition. Sorry, Smyrna, definitely second. But earlier in the first century, Smyrna was the one that won the bidding to be host city of a temple for emperor worship. Rome, your power will never end, was the kind of thing they said in Smyrna. They really knew how to suck up. And Smyrna's loyalty to Rome was what presented the problems for the church there, which had a bigger loyalty. Jesus' appraisal offers no complaints about Smyrna church. He has plenty negative to say about most of the others we'll go on to meet. And it's quite a good selling point, really, isn't it? If you're trying to attract new people in the marketplace of churches at this time of year, hey, we're the congregation that Jesus had nothing bad to say about. Great, I'll join. Just one thing you should know, persecution guaranteed in this church. Sign you up for a small group. I wonder, would you join a small group in Baghdad at the moment? Friends who are church planters there right now say that one of the big problems in engaging Christians in personal evangelism is not that they're not trained enough to open the Bible with a friend. It's that they're worried they might be imprisoned if they're caught doing it. Would you even risk owning a dangerous Bible? That seems to be the issue there in North Korea. Who'd be a Christian there? Well, people who have their eyes fixed on a very big Jesus. And that's why I love this little letter to the church in Smyrna. It's not just yet another passage that says the Christian life is tough. It's so compact that at every point it drives you to think about what you think about him. And we will need to do that, because if any of us are going to endure as faithful followers, we'll need more than staying power. We need a clear vision of the one we follow. So, to the church in Smyrna and North Korea and London today, Jesus writes, verse 9, I know. Not because the news had gradually filtered back to HQ. Jesus knows because he walks among the churches, remember we saw last week. He knows the details of their tribulation. That word means pressed on, literally. It's what you do to grapes when you're making wine. It's how it felt to be a Christian in Smyrna. He knows their poverty too, it says, not because Smyrna was a poor place. They were booming thanks to Rome. A Christian bishop called Polycarp was martyred in Smyrna in about 150 AD, so about 60-ish years on from what we're reading here. And there's a little book called The Martyrdom of Polycarp that contains eyewitness testimony. See, in Asia Minor, religion wasn't just about religion, it was partly about economics. So the trade guilds had Roman gods you were expected to swear oaths to, whatever you actually thought of them. And religion was political too. So loyalty to Rome meant, publicly at least, acknowledging the emperor as a god, of which the Christians in Smyrna could never do. I am the first and the last. Besides me, there is no God, says the Lord, the King of Israel and his Redeemer. So you got sacked, or no one did business with you. You were an unlucky charm in that sense, disloyal to the cause. The Barnabas Fund recently reported the story of Ashok, a daily wage worker in India. His already meager earnings stopped when lockdown kicked in and prevented him going to work. Hindu extremists dominate the government in the province of India where Ashok lives. And because he was a Christian, that meant he didn't get any food rations. I'm afraid that's a familiar story today in India and in Pakistan. Persecution at the hands of other religious people has always been a feature. Verse 9. I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich, and the slander of those who say that they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. That's really strong language, isn't it? It's not anti-Semitic. Remember, Jesus was Jewish born. It's just that in Smyrna, the bad mouthing of the believers came from within the synagogue community. Jesus says people who slander his faithful ones are really being used by Satan. More of him next week. Smyrna actually gives us a window into a slightly more nuanced understanding of what life was like in parts of the empire. Not quite as simple as we either like you or we'll throw you to the lions. Death is mentioned here, as is prison, but economic consequences too, and reputational damage. Actually, wherever you refuse to compromise with the prevailing culture, you will find yourself sitting on that spectrum somewhere, even if it's just the seeds of minor slander. So everyone else is making a gesture of support for a certain cause. You don't feel you should. Ancestor veneration that you refuse to engage in. Maybe it's the awkward claims of Jesus that you stand by. Expect people to say things about you. Of course, not all the time like back then. Many in the Roman world loved the Christians. But do you ever wonder what they say about you behind your back? What they think? The family? The colleagues? Those new university friends? Even if they say the things to our face, it usually doesn't produce the more serious consequences that the slander in Smyrna led to. Still painful, though. And Jesus knows. Not just actually knows that it's going on. He knows from his own personal experience what tribulation is, and poverty, and to be slandered. The first and the last who died and came to life, he is present with his faithful ones today whenever they experience these things. And he says, don't fear, which is our second point. Verse 10, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Often it's the fear of what's about to happen or what might happen to us that makes us censor ourselves, isn't it? The HR department or the students' union don't actually have to do anything if we've got enough fear in us. I actually don't know many Christians in London who've lost their jobs for being Christian. I know one or two who've been told off pretty seriously. Couple of others who've been asked not to volunteer for a certain project. But I know a lot of Christians in London who fear the consequences of them being too bold. Quite interesting pastoral care from Jesus here. Not don't fear, the worst probably won't happen. He actually assures them that it definitely is going to happen. Verse 10. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days, you will have tribulation. Great. Of course, the comfort is that Jesus is in control. That reference to 10 days is quite precise. It could be literal. The 10 days of intense persecution against the church in a town could do some pretty serious damage. Remember, though, numbers in Revelation can be symbolic. Daniel and his friends were tested for 10 days in similar circumstances. It could be a reference to that. The point is, it's a specific period of time which Jesus knows and knows will end. The first and the last sees all of history laid before him. Lots of speculation at the moment about whether things will get worse for believers here in the UK as our country increasingly moves away from our very ingrained Christian heritage. People wonder whether it will be much harder for our children growing up trying to be faithful in 50, 100 years' time. I don't know. We don't know the future. But we know the one who does know and who does hold the future. And so he says, be faithful unto death. This is verse 10 again. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Again, unusual comfort. It suggests some of them will die, which happened in Smyrna. That bishop Polycarp was one of the martyrs. And actually, you know, people just like you die all the time for believing in Jesus. Those North Korean Christians, poor things. Smyrna, poor Smyrna. No, actually, rich Smyrna. Jesus says in verse 9, I know your tribulation and your poverty, but you are rich. How can he say that? Well, he's not downplaying how much they're being pressed. But it's kind of a profit and loss analysis that he's inviting them to do. Yes, a real cost to being faithful to Jesus. But on the profit side, they've already been made into a kingdom of priests for God. Here they're being promised a crown of eternal life and protection from the second death. What's the second death? In Revelation chapter 20, it's the language for hell. The second death beyond physical death is the place of judgment. Now, we don't like to think about hell, but if it's real as Jesus says it is, and you're being guaranteed protection from it, then you are not the tragedy. And I'm aware that's quite a thing to say to those North Korean Christians. You are not the tragedy, however tough it gets. The tragedy is what Jesus summarized when he said, what does it profit a person to gain the whole world but forfeit their soul? And the tragedy of that is not just for the ones who really do seem to gain the world, like Emperor Domitian. It always makes me so sad, that verse, as I think about people coming to this city, making a little world for themselves, thinking they have it all. Not a thought given to their soul. That's the tragedy. So don't be fooled, says Jesus to his Smyrna church. You are rich in the big scheme of things, and you have blessings that can never be burned up or locked up or crushed down. So be faithful unto death. That was their calling. Maybe it was their mission statement. Smyrna church, faithful unto death. You know, it's our calling too. I don't know if you think about your calling for your life, for your Christian life. Very straightforward. Be loyal to Jesus. Up to and including dying if necessary. And I don't think about that very much. Partly because even by the time I've got to the end of that previous sentence, in my head, I've arrived at the place of saying, yeah, well, that's never going to happen. It might not. But it is what you sign up to when you become a Christian. Take up your cross and follow me. Jesus knew that for many, that would never be just a metaphor. So could you take away from this talk, please, the action point of thinking about that calling? And I know it's not the most cheerful subject and this is all a bit intense, but partly it will help you remember brothers and sisters who are in the middle of serious tribulation. Let's take up Anya's challenge to pray for and give to support our North Korean family. But also, if you think about your calling, it will make you ask questions like, who'd become a Christian? I mean, we don't think about that very much, do we, when the Christian life is, comfortable, fun. But when the issue is faithful unto death, who'd become a Christian? Well, people gripped by a very big vision of Jesus. Verse 8, to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, the words of the first and the last who died and came to life. Can you trust that person with your death? Can you believe promises from the one who knows exactly what's going to happen? One who traveled that journey of faithful unto death and came out victorious at the other end, who lives forever, who reigns supremely, the one who holds the keys to death and Hades. Some of us will go to parts of the world where this letter may feel more immediately relevant. Do you have a big enough Jesus to be faithful unto death? Do you have a big enough Jesus to be faithful unto things that are less than death? He asks us to be faithful unto lost popularity, faithful unto family resentment, faithful unto sacrificing all kinds of ambitions and money and stuff to seek first his kingdom. If Jesus says faithful unto death, wouldn't it be crazy? Maybe I can trust him with those lesser but still real costs as well. Fear of what might happen. It's such a clever tactic of the devil's, isn't it? Or if they knew I believed that, they might misunderstand. If I don't make this just minor compromise, that thing could happen. You know, maybe I could just go for it a bit more. Take some more risks for the sake of being faithful. Trust the outcomes to the one who controls all the outcomes. Polycarp knew a big Jesus, and he needed to because his faithfulness cost him his life. He'd been asked to say, Caesar is Lord. He refused. Where and I'll set you free. Reproach Christ. For 86 years I've been his servant and he's done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me? They pressed him again. Polycarp said, you threaten me with fire which burns for an hour and after a little is extinguished. But you are ignorant of the fire of coming judgment. Soon afterwards, the people began to gather wood. Thus, Polycarp was burned at the stake. Inspiring, isn't it? And horrible. There's nothing romantic about dying like that. But Polycarp knew someone offering a crown of life. And he trusted the voice of Jesus to his persecuted Smyrna church. Jesus, whose same words are by his Spirit a word from the Lord to us here today. So anyone who has an ear, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches.